and welcome back to the Normalize You podcast. I'm your host, Gabby, and today we have an interviewee named Rebecca Erie. Rebecca has a Master's of Arts in Counseling Psychology from the Seattle School of Theology and Psychology and is a licensed mental health therapist in Washington State. She currently lives in New York City. Rebecca has been working as a clinician with eating disorders and trauma since 2011, both at a treatment setting and in private practice. As a therapist, she developed a firsthand knowledge of the complexities and too often the injustices of insurance coverage for eating disorders. She knows that deeper systemic change is required before healing is truly accessible to all. Rebecca began her tenure at Project Heal as a treatment access program director in 2019 and became CEO in April of 2020. She brings to Project Heal a deep passion for expanding access to eating disorder recovery and breaking down barriers for the people that the system fails. She has a unique combination of clinical knowledge of eating disorder treatment, program development experience, and enthusiasm for mobilizing communities toward change. So, without further ado, I would like to introduce to you Rebecca Erie. Hi, Rebecca. How are you? Welcome to the Normalize You podcast.
Hi, I'm so excited to be here. Thanks for having me.
Yes, of course. I'm super stoked to get into this interview and for you to tell us more about Project Heal. So why don't we start off with how did you get involved in Project Heal and why?
That's such a good question. And I know you prepared me for all of these questions. It's a little bit, you want the long version or the short version?
Whatever you feel comfortable chatting about.
Well, I am an eating disorder therapist by trade, and how I got into this work is also a longer story, but essentially eating disorders have always been kind of close at hand in my life, family members, loved ones. I feel like I've been surrounded by eating disorders my whole life, and getting into therapy with people with eating disorders was really transformative for me because it was so inspiring and kind of a game changer to see people who were in treatment, which indicates a baseline level of commitment to healing and willingness to do hard work. And it was so amazing, I think, to see like the beauty and the humanity and the sensitivity of people with eating disorders. And at the same time, I learned as an eating disorder therapist how unjust and inequitable the eating disorder treatment landscape is. I did admissions for a number of years at a treatment center, and we had to turn people away who didn't have the right insurance. And, you know, I was basically the gatekeeper, and there were just a number of people who weren't able to be, who weren't able to access treatment based on the model, which is a complicated system, but it really troubled me because as a healer, you know, you want anyone who's willing and open and ready to recover to have the access to the opportunities to do so. And so saying no to people was really brutal. And I also saw a lot of really unfair insurance denials, people who were very appropriate for treatment being denied because they weren't medically unstable enough, or people being cut off from their insurance prematurely because they were, you know, quote unquote, doing well after 1 or 2 weeks, you know, the sort of double standard of like, if you're doing well, then you leave early. But if you're not doing well, you're non-compliant and there's sort of no way to win.
Yeah.
And I saw that cost people their lives. And so the more that I got into the eating disorder space, I became more overwhelmed with how few people it really caught, how few people it was really able to help. So I ended up taking a break from the clinical field and moving to New York and doing marketing and strategy and communications, and knowing I would return to the field, but a little disillusioned at that point, to be honest. And then I had always known about Project Heal because as someone doing admissions at a treatment center, I knew that one of the only resources I could offer people who couldn't afford care or whose insurance wouldn't cover it was Project Heal, right? They're the only nonprofit that's really doing that work. So I had always known about them, but I found out about a program director position overseeing free treatment placements for people with eating disorders at Project Heal. And I applied and turned out to be kind of a match made in heaven in terms of like all the things that I care about and happen to be good at, which happens to be very, very niche. Was sort of a perfect fit for Project Heal. And then about a year into that role, I stepped into the role of CEO, which I've been doing now for 9 months. And really, since I've taken over the organization, we've doubled down on our treatment access work and really drilled into who needs our support the most, who's most systematically excluded from treatment, who struggles to access treatment the most, and really focused all of our resources and energies in those areas, which has been so beautiful and really, really exciting.
Yeah, that's awesome. I love Project Heal's mission. You're right. It's the only nonprofit that I know that exists, from my knowledge, that provides that kind of treatment care for individuals struggling with eating disorders. So if you can ballpark a number, like annually, I guess, like how many individuals do does Project Heal help with regards to getting the treatment that they need?
I actually know this number. You know, historically, our model was fairly simple, right? Money raised was money spent on treatment for people. We just paid for treatment for people. And that was beautiful and well-intentioned, but super unscalable because treatment is incredibly expensive, right? A single treatment episode can cost $80,000. And so that meant we were helping one or two people a year, which was, again, one or two lives saved and really beautiful and worthwhile. And that's how most nonprofits do it. So I want to caveat the last sentence of like, we're the only people doing this. I will say we're the only major national nonprofit doing this. I've seen a number of like memorial, you know, funds or different small nonprofits sort of dabbling in like giving micro grants or helping people with different things. Treatment centers oftentimes were willing to subsidize people's deductibles and things like that. So there's a certain amount of charity happening at the, in different smaller ways, but in terms of like actually helping people like access free treatment or get into treatment that their insurance won't cover, that they don't have the money to do, Project Heal is for sure the only one doing that at the scale that we're doing it. And we helped in 2020 over 200 people access treatment who weren't able to access it otherwise, which is as many people as we've helped in all 12 years prior cumulatively. So
that's awesome.
We were able to essentially rework our model in a scalable way that, you know, was able to save over 200 lives versus like one at a time necessarily. I mean, it's still one at a time, but it's not nearly like kind of, it's not, I'm struggling to find my words, but there's a way in which this helps us feel like we're able to even make a dent in the scope of the problem, right? There are millions of people who can't access treatment right now. So
yeah,
you're only helping one or two people a year. You feel like you're like not even making a dent in the problem. And I feel really proud and excited that we did such a higher level of work last year. And I'm really excited this year to see how much more we can do.
That's awesome. I mean, it wasn't until I went through my own treatment for my eating disorder that I saw how expensive, like it is ridiculous. Like I remember, I mean, thankfully very privileged to have insurance that like helped me cover a lot of it. But had I not had insurance, I mean, a day of partial hospitalization, which you're there from, you know, let's say, I think it was like 12 to like 7 PM at night, it's like over $1,000 a day. And that just blew my mind.
Yeah. So inpatient can be over $2,000 a day, residential, you know, $1,000 to $1,800 a day, partial hospitalization, $1,000 a day, intensive outpatient, like $1,000 a week. And so when you really think about it, depending on your diagnosis, you may need all of those levels of care in a row. You may need inpatient for a month or two, and then you may need residential for 3 or 4 months. And then you may need partial hospitalization for 3 months. And then IOP for a year. And so you're looking at $250,000 at the end of the day.
Yeah.
And it takes a really long time to recover from an eating disorder. This is not a band-aid problem. These are chronic brain illnesses that take a really long time to rewire. Now, can you medically stabilize someone in a short period of time? Sure.
Yeah.
But does that treat the mental illness of an eating disorder? Does it treat the symptoms and the behaviors and continue them in any long-term way? Anyone who has had or knows anyone who's had an eating disorder knows that that is not what it's about. But insurance companies cover it as though it's a short-term acute illness that is only really worth covering if it's medically, you know, if someone's medically unstable, which is such a scary and limited and dangerous way to look at it. Because, you know, unfortunately, the research shows that one person dies every 52 minutes from their eating disorder. And around half of those are medically related, and those are the people who insurance is willing to throw money at. But the other half are people who commit suicide. And so it's ignoring the mental and psychological toll that eating disorders take to wait for organ failure or a low heart rate or, bone density loss, basically narrowing the field of coverage only to anorexic patients. It's completely ignoring the fact that this is it basically, your brain can kind of become a living hell and you become more and more isolated, and it's really overwhelming. And then when you try to access care and you're denied at every turn, it's no wonder that people become overwhelmingly hopeless and discouraged because the system doesn't seem to think that they're worth taking seriously. So that's what we're here to try to change.
Yeah, definitely. It's interesting. I had a conversation yesterday over Zoom with people that I went to treatment with, and we are all just like checking in on each other, like, hey, almost a year and a half or two later, like, how are y'all doing? How's COVID? All that. How's it treating you? And we got into a really interesting conversation, and I wanted to run these questions by you because it got me thinking a lot. So, one of the questions that I was kind of dabbling in my head was, do you feel like if the person is not wanting to recover, that recovery is not possible.
I do think a baseline willingness is required for recovery to take hold, to sort of truly manifest and to remain stable, right? I mean, if and that's true with anything, like
Yeah, exactly.
no one can make anyone do anything that they don't want to do. However, I, as a clinician, firmly believe that, similar to sobriety or to someone with psychotic features taking medications, wanting to do it at first isn't required. Sometimes there are ways in which you can leverage one place of willingness. Maybe someone is like, okay, I don't want to lose, I don't want to lose custody of my kids, or I don't want to lose my job, or I don't want to lose. So they're like, okay, so you have a hook. They're not willing to give up their eating disorder yet, but they don't want one of the consequences of their eating disorder. So you can leverage that to get someone nourished and get someone stable, and or in the case of sobriety, to get someone sober, or in the case of, requiring medication in order to think clearly, like medicated, because once a brain is nourished or sober or medicated, right, you have suddenly a way better ability to assess reality, to make good decisions for yourself. And so waiting for an ill mind to like know what's good for them, or to know to want good things for themselves, like part of the problem is sometimes they don't know that they deserve good things and they don't know how to accept good things. And so I don't think we have to wait until someone's ready or excited. We can start where someone is, but at a certain point, it will need to become their own work. And it needs to become like genuinely, it has to pour out from their genuine intentions. Because, there's nothing more frustrating than I've treated people who are like undercutting you at every turn, right? Like they're sneaking purging, and they're hiding food, and they're, not taking their meds, or they're sabotaging themselves left and right. And it's sort of like, okay, I can't make you want to live. I can't make you want to recover. And in those cases, sometimes you do have to wait until someone's ready. And the sad thing is that not everyone will ever get there. And I don't know how to conceptualize that, but it is true. And at a certain point, we don't have to get too far into this. At a
No,
certain
yeah.
point, like everyone has the right to do what they want to do with their own bodies.
Yeah.
And sometimes that means harming them. And that's sort of like autonomy and consent, and those things are so important, and they sometimes have sad consequences. But most of the time, at the core, people have a genuine instinctive desire to survive. They have an instinctive desire to connect. They have an instinctive desire to be loved, and so finding that, figuring out what the eating disorder is serving, and like reframing some things is really necessary to do in most cases. Because if people could figure this out on their own, and just if it was only about wanting it, you know, people wouldn't need treatment.
Yeah, of course. Have you ever had to draw the line as a therapist, or that boundary with like, hey, we can't continue therapy because maybe things weren't changing for a prolonged period of time, or that instinct willingness was just not there?
I have. It's a last resort. And usually I would say is done in a sort of ultimatum type of way. And I mean, ultimatums are kind of brutal, not relationally recommended. You know, nobody loves an ultimatum, but there are, you know, situations in which I've had somebody who, I'm thinking of one man in particular who had really severe chronic anorexia and just would do the work, weight restore, and then every time he discharged immediately would tank. And we had to set up protocols where, you know, his provider needed a doctor's letter to return to work. And at one point we said, we won't sign the letter for you to return to work. So in some ways, like saying, you know, your livelihood, your employment requires your recovery. And so, you know, at that point he has a choice, and thankfully he made a good choice. But he could have made the other choice, and we would have had to sort of draw that line. And the truth is that he would have come back. Mm-hmm. Unless, of course, he didn't come back, which would be the sadder outcome.
Of course.
But he made the right call and is recovered now, to my knowledge, which is great.
Yeah. That's awesome. Yeah. It was, like I said, yesterday's conversation was really interesting, and it broke my heart to hear one of the individuals that I actually didn't know personally through treatment, but she had known the other people in the group, that she's been struggling with an eating disorder for over 20 plus years. Anorexia was the main, the main culprit. And, she's kind of gotten to a point where she's like, I have an extreme fear of gaining weight. I have an extreme fear of being fat. And I think I'm just going to live in this orthorexic place, because I know I never want to go back to anorexia. I dabbled in binge eating, and that I think just really messed up with her head and her emotions and body image. And so now she's just kind of, you know, she didn't want to say hopelessness, but she almost kind of said it. She was just kind of like, I don't think I could ever really learn to love my body unless I stay in this orthorexic place.
Yeah. I've met folks like that too. And the truth is that nothing lasts forever. And so maybe that is a workable solution for them. And I've seen therapists work with clients on a harm reduction model where they say, we keep trying to get you to this certain definition of recovery and you can't seem to get there and refuse to get there. And so what if we helped you stay alive in this like not fully recovered place? And is that actually good care? Mm-hmm. I think that's a very last ditch effort for most clinicians. Some people are fundamentally opposed to it. But I do think it makes some sense in certain cases, but then I come back to this idea that nothing lasts forever. Like at some point it will either fade away and they'll recover and grow out of it because they're steadily more nourished, or they'll will, you know, escalate in their behaviors, or it will get out of control in some way. I think that it is a myth that you can maintain closeness with an eating disorder and stay in control. I don't believe that that's true.
Yeah.
I think the eating disorder has a mind of its own, and it has moving targets. Everyone knows that, like, you know, the weight that you think you're okay with one day can change the next. And, you know, just like any addictive behavior, you know, I think about this a lot. Like when a person restricts, their brain releases endorphins, which have a similar chemical reaction in your brain to heroin. And so there's some interesting research around essentially like, you need to restrict more and more and more to get the same release of endorphins to get that same high or that same buzz, which is why restriction typically escalates and people don't sort of stay static at a certain level of restriction. So this is why it feels a little bit like worth trying if you've tried everything else 100 times, but I don't know how realistic or successful it is. And I've also seen people at the other end of the spectrum be in very, very medically compromised bodies, and not only refuse to go to treatment, but said, I'm going to hire a hospice team. I know I'm going to die of my eating disorder, and I've accepted that. And I'm going to like, just keep myself comfortable until I go. This person was like, you know, I don't remember, in their 30s or 40s, you know, not in their 80s, not at the end of a long, full life. And so to see someone just like with full clarity of mind, at least from all observable indicators, say, not only do I not have my survival instinct is not there anymore, like I don't want, I actually, you know, refuse to do this. And in that case, what can you do? There is no such thing in most states. The laws vary by state, but most states cannot mandate a person to be in treatment as an adult against their will. So it's always voluntary admission. And that's a really sad reality. But, you know, these cases that we're talking about are rarer than
more
the reality that people, for the most part, that are struggling with their eating disorders would give anything to not have them. And they want freedom from them, and they want all the things that are on the other side of their eating disorder, and they just don't know how to get there.
Yeah. Would you say that? I used to think differently, so I'm curious as what you think, but I used to be like, oh, well, recovery means something different for everybody. But I don't know, the more I've studied it and I'm now going to be specializing in it, there's some aspects of recovery that just, they are, you're recovered or you're not. Like, you're nourishing your body and you're intuitively eating or you're not. And so for me, I don't know how flexible that definition is. And so I'm curious as to what you think.
Intuitive eating is tricky when it comes to socioeconomic status, right? So intuitive eating has a lot, it really depends on full access to a variety of foods, right? If you are going to eat what you're in the mood for and as much as you want until you're full, it really requires you to have enough money to pay for the food that you want and the amount of food that you want. So there's a little bit of classism in the intuitive eating world. Am I a fan of intuitive eating? Literally live and die by it. Like, it's my favorite. but I think it's important to note that it's not available to everyone.
Yeah, very true.
But I do think there are a couple key things that that recovery does require. And the simplest definition in my mind is genuinely like, you don't meet criteria for an eating disorder anymore. So you look back, you look at the diagnostic statistic manual, you literally like go through the diagnoses, and you just simply aren't using behaviors, right? In any kind of measurably, you know, it's very, I have my little DSM here. you know, if you are in recovery from bulimia and you're no longer binging and purging, you're in recovery from bulimia. Like, do you still have fat phobia? Maybe. Do you still have, you know, diet mentality? Maybe. Would you be better off and more fully recovered if you dismantled those? Yes. But if you are not using behaviors, you know, or if you have a history of anorexia, you're eating, you know, the appropriate amount of nutrition and your weight is relatively stable. You know, if you are recovering from ARFID, you're able to eat a variety of foods, and you're able to maintain an appropriate weight. If you have binge eating, if you're in recovery from binge eating disorder, you have rare, if ever, binge eating episodes. Those people get to call themselves recovered because they don't meet criteria for an eating disorder anymore. And that's huge. And that's something worth celebrating.
Yeah. 100%.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's just an interesting question that I had, because I think, again, we were having this conversation and it was like, oh, well, I don't even know what recovery, some people are saying like, I don't even know what recovery means or what it feels like. And so, yeah, I think I like the way that you put it, because I think it's a standardized way to kind of look at it to some degree. But yeah, it's just interesting, because I think at one point I used to believe, I think this was more when I was in my eating disorder, I used to believe, oh, well, like, recovery is very different for everybody. So like, I can eat XYZ foods, but I can't eat that, but I'm recovered, you know? So
it's everything, everything's on a spectrum in the world.
Yes.
So we can all look at, like, there are people who I believe their recovery is so deep. They have done so much cognitive shifting, depth of processing. They have completely, radically revolutionized their relationship with food and with body, that I believe those people might even be impervious to relapse, right? Like that something terrible could happen in their life and they would like not return to the eating disorder. It wouldn't even occur to them. I know some of those people. I also know people who are mostly recovered, or would say that they're fully recovered, but would be at risk of going back to their eating disorder kind of on accident, or, you know, unbeknownst to them, if something terrible happened, right? Like a huge loss or a huge triggering event, it might be like kind of closer to the surface. And then there are people who I think who are more like just behaviorally letter of the law recovered, right? They're not using behaviors anymore, who I think are very prone to relapse because they haven't fully dismantled all the underlying reasons for it. They haven't completely revolutionized how they look at food and their body, and they don't have replacement things as they don't have as many, you know, really rich relationships with the life and the other survival and coping mechanisms that have replaced the eating disorder. So it's like really varies based on, I think, how deep it's gone. Time certainly helps, right? Like in terms of just habits, like if you've been adequately nourished for 10 or 20 years, like even if you still have, you know, really severe body image issues, you're just a lot less likely to go back to the behaviors because they don't make as much sense anymore. Those neural pathways have been overridden for long enough. So I think it really varies, but it certainly in terms of like what I think is fully possible for someone with an eating disorder, like I think the sky's the limit in terms of like you can be someone who like never has an eating disorder thought. I think that's possible.
Yeah.
I've seen that happen.
Really?
Uh-huh. It's really awesome. Cool. Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, I'm sure. That's really, really cool. Yeah. If you don't mind sharing, what's been your personal history with eating disorders, or have you ever had any history with that or personal body struggles, relationship with food? I know you kind of mentioned that you had a lot of loved ones or people that you knew that struggled.
Sorry, I just took a sip of coffee. I'm not delaying answering your question.
Oh no, you're fine. You're fine.
I'm very, very comfortable answering this. So thanks for asking.
Of course.
It's complicated as all the things are. The simple answer is that I have not ever been diagnosed with an eating disorder. You know, my mom had anorexia growing up and still does. My sister struggled with bulimia for a number of years. Those people were very influential in my life. I think a lot of my own relationship with food growing up as a kid was influenced by my desire not to be anything like my mom, and also was influenced by my genetics, which predisposed me to being in a thin body regardless of what I ate. And so I really had a lot of privileges and protective mechanisms against following in my mom's footsteps. But I have all of the a lot of predisposing factors. I've got control issues, I have a trauma history. I'm a female in America, you know, like I've certainly struggled with body image. I've spent time being preoccupied with how I look or trying to change how I look. I've not ever gone on official diets again because of the privilege I have of being in a genetically thin body. Mm-hmm. But I've been restrictive at times for sure.
Yeah.
I'm sure I've even binged, at times, probably following episodes of restricting.
That's usually how it goes.
Usually. Yeah. Never struggled with compulsive exercise or any other kind of purging. Generally don't tend to have a compensatory mindset, just as a, like a person. Mm-hmm. I will say that I had an episode following, I'm 37 and I got divorced when I was 30 after being married for a few years. I got married when I was 25. And my divorce was super distressing to me. And I was actually an eating disorder therapist at the time. And so I went through a period of anorexic behaviors for sure. I lost a decent amount of weight, which I did not have to lose. And I was preoccupied with weighing myself. I sort of made it into this weird competition with myself. All the red flags were there, and anyone talking to me would have said, yeah, you are acting like an anorexic person. Mm-hmm. The reason I don't call that me having experience with an eating disorder is that I, first of all, mostly out of integrity, being an eating disorder therapist, saw that it was happening and said, I either need to leave my job or I need to do something about this, like right now.
Yeah, of course.
And the truth is that I just immediately did something about it, right? Like I immediately started eating more. I started eating what our patients would eat when they're weight restoring, just eating like very high calorie, like nutrient dense, large volume meals. And I, you know, used Supplement or Boost, as some may be familiar with. I just fully on my own, weight restored, and got myself back to my set weight. And I did that without internal torture or a lot of struggle, and I didn't need a treatment team to help me with it. And to me, like, that's why it doesn't meet the threshold, right? If you can turn the page when you see yourself going down a certain path, and you can do that without a complicated internal experience about it, and without any hiccups or, you know, backstepping or whatever, that backsliding. Mm-hmm. I just don't think that that meets criteria. An eating disorder is like really, really hard to recover from. And I feel like if in my case, you know, I sort of just overrode whatever grief I had that was driving me to this weird place where I was trying to control my body. And I just did the thing, and it was over in a couple of months. And so I don't consider myself someone who's struggled with an eating disorder for that reason, but I do feel like I understand what it is to lose weight rapidly, be forced to gain weight rapidly. Like, I've had that bodily experience. Mm-hmm. I've had a weird obsession at time, you know, during a time in my life when everything felt out of control with what my body was like and what I was putting in my mouth. And, I didn't want to tell anyone about it. And I also really wanted people to notice and be worried about me, that dichotomy. Like, so I understand, like, from experience what that feels like, but again, I don't think I meet the full threshold for that.
Yeah.
And I've just also had, so everyone, I would say the vast majority, 75% of my closest friends have a history of an eating disorder. I don't know what it is. Maybe it's that everyone, so many people have a history of an eating disorder. I don't know if it's just like, that's how common it is, or if I have been drawn to people who feel deeply and who have a lot of connection to their body and a lot of those traits that predispose someone to have an eating disorder. Like, those are some of my favorite traits in people.
Yeah. If
people who are predisposed to eating disorders are like brilliant, complicated survivors who find really elegant and complex metaphors for their pain. I kind of love those people. So a lot of my friends are recovered, and I just feel like I, growing up with it and having experienced a small bout and treating it for years and so many friends with it, it's like, I understand it more than I have any right to in some ways.
Yeah, definitely. I think the prevalence is insane, because I honestly cannot think off the top of my head a friend that I've had friends that have had eating disorders, but I don't think I've ever had a friend that hasn't had body image struggles, or, you know, a temporary struggle with relationship with food or wanting to go on a diet. I mean, diet culture is so normalized. So,
yeah, it's everywhere you look. And I think that, I think as our culture evolves to start moving away from diet culture as being normative, and the louder that movement gets, to normalize bodies and normalize foods, like the name of this podcast, subtle plug, the more that becomes normative, I think that more and more people will realize, oh yeah, I did that for a long time. I just don't know that people think of dieting as restricting. I don't think they think of their exercise plan as a form of purging. I don't think people even know how to define a binge. Like, I don't think people have language for it. And so as people learn, I think more and more people will say, oh yeah, for sure. And I think more and more people are. And that's what's so interesting. It's like the number of people who I know who would say that they had an eating disorder when they were younger, or that they sometimes still struggle with that, who for all intents and purposes have never been diagnosed and never been treated and aren't even on that radar. You know, that goes to show to me like how many people are not represented in that number of 30 million Americans struggling with an eating disorder. I think it's like hundreds of millions. Like, I think it's just so many more.
100%.
At least disordered eating, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, definitely.
I think that's a helpful distinction. It's like eating disorders need to meet a certain, you know, threshold criteria. That's how we research. That's how we diagnose. And that's how we build evidence-based care. So it's like, you have to define mental illnesses. You can't just say like, oh, you feel bad in your body, you have an eating disorder.
Yeah.
But disordered eating is a huge,
very common
catch-all. And I think I think it's just way rarer to meet someone who does not have any history of disordered eating. I can't think of anybody that
I agree
I know.
100%. What would you say as a professional? And then also, I know you kind of mentioned mom and sister had history, possibly still do. What would you tell someone that's like, I don't know what to do. My mom or my dad or my sister is like very active in their eating disorder. I'm recovered and I'm in a good space, but it's not healthy for me to be around them.
That's really tough and happens a lot. I've treated so many young people whose parents have undiagnosed eating disorders, and it's really complicates the recovery journey, especially when so much of eating disorder recovery has to do with family meals
Yes.
and people living at home. I think the this is this is a complicated subject.
Yeah.
Research shows that a parent does not have to be recovered in order to support their child's recovery. So that's a sentence that's true. Another sentence that's true is, if you're an adult, you can have whatever boundaries are appropriate for you with anyone, even if they're your blood relatives. And I don't think that, if someone is repeatedly and overtly harmful and refuses to change, and the harm they're causing is threatening your safety, please take that seriously. I don't have a relationship with my mom. I haven't actually spoken to her since 2012, which is a whole different story, and not because of her eating disorder, but because of other personality disorder, addiction stuff in my mom's life. But, it's way healthier for me to not be in touch with her. And I regularly reflect on how much more stable my own mental health is and my own life is by not having contact with her. Again, it's also super painful, so I wouldn't recommend it for everyone. But, and there are times also you can take a season, right? If your recovery is really fragile right now, maybe you take a break. That's okay too. It doesn't have to last forever. I do think that when people who are working on their recovery require everyone around them to do the things that they're doing and think like them, it can become another way of trying to control something that's out of your control. And I think real recovery really does require us to be able to hold on to our own, concept of our own minds and our own relationship with food, regardless of who we're in the presence of, because there isn't any way to maintain recovery in this world as it exists without having a certain resilience in the face of unhelpful comments, diet culture, medical discrimination. Oh, people in large bodies, people in fat bodies are being like openly verbally assaulted on the street all the time, in addition to a million other forms of discrimination that they experience. And so, tragically, but honestly, people really need to be able to sort of shift their locus of control to being an internal one. If you're waiting for the world to agree to like reflect back to you your values of intuitive eating and body neutrality or body whatever positivity, you'll be waiting a really long time. So we can't wait for the world to be the soil, the rich soil for our recovery to grow in. We can only do what we can, like with the resources that we have, and a lot of that's our own internal work.
Yeah, I definitely agree with everything you said. And especially too, it's like you can't expect to go around the world and tell everybody to eat the way that you eat or the recovered way that you are, right? And I know me personally through my own recovery, I had a tough relationship with my mom because so many factors, just like our eating was very different. And sometimes I felt like it was against my recovery. And so navigating that was really tough. But I also reminded myself, and my therapist at the time did too, is like, you can't control what other people eat or how they decide to live their life. At the end of the day, you have to be sound and stable in your recovery and just remind yourself why you're doing what you're doing and how it's benefiting you, right?
Yeah, and obviously, at first, I think it's worth being super delicate with yourself. I think going into like if you're new or in recovery or feeling more vulnerable or triggered, like maybe don't go home for that holiday meal, or maybe just like take a break, or I think it's okay to say, I think of this analogy all the time. Like, you know, if you're actively doing really hard work on your own mental health and psychology and in your own recovery, like, I think of it as like open heart surgery. And it's like imagining if the surgeon was like smoking in the OR, you know, it's like, okay, let's keep all the toxins out while you're like, you know, chest cavity is wide open. Once you're like closed back up and like healing and the stitches are in place, like maybe people can come around you and like, you know, you grow your capacity to tolerate things. And I do think it's really okay to say, please don't talk about that around me. I don't want to talk about my body. I don't want to talk about food. Like you can refuse to engage in conversation with anyone, but you can change how they think about their body or how they think about your body or how people eat. It comes back to that autonomy thing, right? Like we can't have the ability to do what we want with our own bodies if we don't allow other people the freedom to do what they want with their own bodies.
100%, for sure. So one of the last kind of questions I wanted to ask you, which I think is a really important one. So what would you say to anybody that needs treatment for an eating disorder but is unable to afford it and, you know, doesn't get the scholarship or the funding from Project Heal? It's hard. I know it's a hard question, but
So let me just make sure I understand the question. So somebody needs treatment, they can't afford it, their insurance won't cover it, and we say no because we don't have
yeah.
resources. Okay.
Yes.
Oh, this is the question that breaks my heart.
I know.
I would say there are some ways to do this. One is legal routes, right? There are appeals. There is a list of attorneys on our website that will take your case if you're being unfairly denied care that you're legally entitled to, which happens all the time. Granted, it's not a short-term solution that will get you the treatment that you need right now, but it is something you are entitled to do. I would say their crowdfunding is like something that people are doing a lot of right now. A lot of people are doing like mutual aid. And if you're willing to share your story publicly, like ask your community for help and share it on your social media. And I've seen people raise thousands and thousands of dollars for care and they never imagined people would give and they never imagined it would work. And they're so humbled by the outpouring of support for their community. I think the vulnerability to ask for what we need from our community is like sometimes life-changing. And so like community care is a huge thing, right? It's like we can't always things should work a certain way, right? Like the government should protect us, our insurance should pay for our care, all of these things should work. Nonprofits like Project Heal should be able to supplement everyone who isn't getting what they need from the other existing systems. But like people are amazing, right? Some of the most beautiful things I've seen are when people just rally around someone that they know, a neighbor, someone in need, and they just like sacrifice and they show up for them. And that happens. It always, you know, gives me chills and it makes me tear up because it's beautiful. So I wouldn't be afraid to pursue that avenue. And then I would also say, you know, this is not. Oh, third, I would say if there's any way to get a qualifying event to get new insurance, I would do that. So, I mean, the truth is like, there's a couple things that are qualifying events. Moving. If you're like, I need treatment and I need new insurance and I can't get it because it's not the open enrollment period, and you're like, this, like, my life depends on this, do you have anyone you can move to? Like, do you have a
That's so
family that lives
smart.
in another state and move, and then you have a new address and you get new insurance.
That's so
And
true.
monthly premium is way less expensive than treatment. Okay, and last but not least, I would say if all else fails and literally nothing else works, first of all, you can always reapply to Project Heal. So never give up on that if as like a backup option. But there are people who I've seen, you know, like in really difficult situations with limited resources that just piecemeal together something for themselves that sort of works and is good enough for now. And I think it's a little bit of a, it's sad. It's like, you know, they deserve so much more and it's tragic and it's unjust. And like, I will never stop fighting for those people. And There are some really amazing free resources. There are free support groups. There are free mentors through ANID.org, which is, you know, they took over our Communities of Healing program and have been doing peer support for 45 years. And those resources are free. You know, there's a lot of really great online resources. There are, you know, there's your Normalize You guide that synthesizes a ton of stuff that people do learn in treatment. There are, you know, for $15.99, there's like an ACT eating disorder workbook for your specific diagnosis. Like, I'm not saying you should have to do it alone. I'm not saying it's as good.
Of course, yeah.
Like, it's not as good, but like, there are affordable sort of self ways we can do this. We can ask our friends and family for like, build a schedule, ask, you know, ask the 10 people that you know to join you for breakfast, lunch, and dinner and sit with you and say, you know, figure out what you need to get through that meal. Like, invite accountability, you know, put your plan together. Even Medicare and Medicaid will cover a doctor's office appointment. And if you don't have any insurance, a doctor's appointment's like $250. Most doctors are not aware of eating disorders. So it's frustrating, but if you find one, at the very least, you know, don't ask for your weight to be revealed to you, but tell them what your goal is. Like, I want to restore X amount of weight, and let them track it for you and make it extremely clear why you don't want to know about it. You know what I mean? Like,
of course,
I'm not saying it's good enough, but there is a way to sort of piecemeal together, like, a version of an IOP for yourself, right?
100%. Yeah, definitely.
And it's certainly worth trying. It's better than saying, oh, I guess I don't get into treatment, so I can't do anything. So I guess I'll just see where this eating disorder takes me. Like, that is not the path to choose.
Yeah. Thank you so much for that feedback. And thank you so much for having this conversation with me. I love chatting with you. I know we could probably go on for hours, but it's just been such an informative and educational conversation that I think a lot of people are going to benefit from. So I'm very humbled and grateful that you were able to be on the podcast.
Thank you, Gabby. Thanks so much for having me.
Yes, of course. Have a great day.
You too. Bye.